Well, we've been tapping into the minds of our wise men, our wise advisors on what to do next with the BizNews model portfolios. And I'm really glad to be talking today to Andrew Lapping. Andrew's well known in South Africa. He joined Allan Gray in 2001 and was the chief investment officer in 2016, left in 2020 and joined, I suppose, a colleague, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, at Ranmore with Sean Pesch. He's been with Sean for the last 3 years. He's the Chief Investment Officer of Ranmore. Andrew, we've got to start at the beginning. Dr. Simon Marais is a huge influence. Funny, this morning in my reading, I was asked, who are my heroes? Well, when it comes to investments, definitely Dr. Simon Marais was my hero. You work closely with him. And I have no doubt that some of that must have rubbed off on you, and in the same way as it's definitely rubbed off on Sean.
Yeah, and thanks, Alec, and thanks for the welcome. It's great to be here. It's funny, without a doubt, Simon would be my kind of, if I think about how I should think about stocks, I think of Simon. Both from a kind of very logical, methodical way of thinking, as well as just being an extremely nice person, extremely genuine, good person to be around. So for sure, Simon is my, I would say, mentor / hero of how I go about investing, and I think for life in general.
Yeah, it is interesting that, isn't it? When you look at people who've done very well in investing, like a Dr. Simon Marais, the late Dr. Simon Marais, and Warren Buffett, their advice doesn't just apply to investments, but it is much broader.
For sure. I mean, in kind of how you treat your family, how you treat people, how you treat colleagues. I think Warren Buffett is also someone who treats people well and thinks about those kind of things. And without a doubt, Simon thought about those things very carefully and spent a lot of time with his family. He had a very nice wife, very nice family who I was fortunate to meet and spend time with as well, which was fantastic.
So why did you decide to leave Allan Gray in 2020? At the time, you were top of the South African investment pile. You guys were managing huge amounts of public money. You were the chief investment officer, so you were the main man. And you bailed out.
Yeah, I think it's a confluence of a few reasons. I mean, for starters, we've got young children, and in terms of safety and security, we were quite keen to move to Europe. Unfortunately, South Africa's got many fantastic things, and if I was a single man, without a doubt, I'd live in Cape Town. But I've got a family. I've got to think about their safety and security. And then from a work point of view, I'd been with Allan Gray for 20 years. And I enjoyed it thoroughly. I worked with great people. I learned what I know about investing there at Allan Gray. But being a chief investment officer at Allan Gray is a very stressful job. You're managing money for hundreds of thousands of people. You're looking after a relatively big team. I got to take their interests into account. So it is pretty stressful. And the other thing about Allan Gray, as I'm sure everyone knows, Allan Gray looks at South Africa and Africa. I was very fortunate to run a part of our Africa Equity Fund, which was fantastic. But it is a relatively limited market. And the other thing about investing is you're taking lots of small decisions. And let's say you want to get 60% of them right. It's much easier to get 60 right if you take 100 decisions. Your kind of skills far more in your favor. While oftentimes in the SA market, you're not taking 60 decisions, you're taking maybe 3 decisions. Am I long or short Naspers? Am I long or short mining stocks? And maybe am I long or short Richemont? I mean, that's the investment universe to an extent. So I was kind of felt like a change. So I moved over to Europe, which has been great. And, I was at first just deciding I was going to just look after my own savings and try and grow them. But I knew Sean from a long time ago and kind of ended up working with him. So that's how I ended up at Ranmore.
And Ranmore's been an incredible performer right up at the top of all of the performance charts. And this is not us saying it, because we are close to Ranmore, and we've I've known Sean like you for many, many years, and it's lovely to see how well Ranmore is doing. But just about everywhere that you look on the Morningstar and other performance tables, it's really done well. And yet you're a small team. So how do you explain that?
Thanks, Alec. I mean, this year for sure has been tough for performance, but the last 3 or 4 years have been good. So in actual fact, if you think, when do many asset managers generate good outperformance? Is it when they're extremely large? I mean, some do it when they're extremely large, like, let's say, Renaissance Technologies, which has done it for 30 years and are large. But most do it when they're relatively small. And I think there are a few things to do with that. The one is very direct decision-making. So it's a few analysts and someone looking after the portfolio. There's no kind of breaking of information flow. The other thing, it's very easy to admit you're wrong in a small team. At Ranmore, if we're working on something, if we own something in the portfolio and suddenly news comes to light or we change our minds, we're happy to admit it. Listen here, we think we made a mistake and we sell it. But at Ranmore, we just approach the world with an open mind and look for stocks that we think are undervalued, whether they be in Hong Kong, Japan, America. We look everywhere. And we've been fortunate to identify some companies which were ignored by the market for whatever reason, and they've contributed nicely to our returns. And at the same time, we've been fortunate not to own some of the stocks which have done poorly, which had become very popular. Like, let's call them the kind of consumer products companies and the big European consumer products companies, the big branded companies. We didn't own those. So that's on a relative side. But yeah.
So how do you go about selecting the stocks that you invest in? How do they come across your radar?
So for identifying companies, we've got a few different methods. We've got kind of traditional screening methods, which I guess everyone uses on Bloomberg and so on. And people weigh things differently. So some people, when they screen for stocks, the most important factor they're looking for is revenue growth. Others might be operating profit growth. For us, it's cash flow, balance sheet, and is the company growing or shrinking? Okay, that's kind of our, and then return on capital is our kind of main screening methods. But where we've actually found, I'd say, most of our good investment ideas is fishing where the fish are. So Sean and I chat about it and we say, where's out of favor? So a few years ago, Japan was extremely out of favor before Warren Buffett spoke about it and so on. So we said, let's just focus our efforts in Japan. And we're just looking at stocks in Japan. And we found some great investment ideas. Then when South America or Latin America was very out of favor, we spent a lot of time looking at Latin America. And this kind of goes on. So even things like in 2022, post Putin's invasion of Ukraine, where unfortunately we had some Russian stocks, which we wrote down to zero, that didn't put us off. We then said, okay, what's fallen as a result of that? And all the periphery countries, whether it be Georgia, Kazakhstan, etc., people were worried that Putin would invade them next, and their stock markets collapsed. Well, we didn't think he was wrong. We were wrong on Ukraine for sure, but we didn't think he would invade those countries next. So we invested in those opportunities, and we did quite well out of that. So a lot of our best investments have come from fishing where the fish are, where other people are not looking.
Mm. Well, we've got a big question that we're dealing with at BizNews, given that we've been running model portfolios now, one for 10 years and the other one for 3 years. And they have been exposed to exponentially growing companies, which have done phenomenally well. In some cases, there's a strong case to be said for them being overinflated. In fact, your colleague, Sean Pesch, took us through the Palantir story, just through the numbers earlier in the week, and made a compelling case for a company that's way above where its fair value is. I really want to ask you about the six big points, though, the six big issues that are causing anyone, or will cause any investor pause. And the first of these is Donald Trump in the United States. Then Elon Musk going in there, and well, we don't know what either of those two volatile characters are going to actually impose on the rest of us. Bitcoin getting to nearly $100,000, which has to be telling us something. The escalation, dramatic escalation in the conflict in Ukraine, Russia, which as Clem Sunter suggests could be is a big flag. He says it's up between 10% and 20% that we will have World War III as a consequence. Warren Buffett, we've published a piece on BizNews this morning saying that his cash pile has now gone to $325 billion. That's inconceivable almost to think of that. That's what the market, the whole value of his company was not that long ago. And then here in South Africa, the whole government of national unity, which is pretty fragile. I got a feeling you're going to come back and say, well, these are big stories and big pictures, and actually you invest in companies. But I'd really like to get your thoughts on all of those issues, and whether, if your portfolio is in a kind of a risky area, that these are issues that you should be taking into consideration.
No, I mean, I have an opinion. My opinion may be wrong or maybe right, but I definitely have views on most of those issues, if not all of them.
Well, let's start off then on Trump.
Yeah, so, I mean, would I vote for Trump? No, I wouldn't vote for him for various reasons. That being said, people have obviously got very excited about, let's call it the Trump presidency, and let's talk about how it affects the stock market. So people have got very excited about the stock market. Why? It's because, well, he's going to cut regulation, he's likely going to cut taxes. Both of these things are good for business. That being said, what concerns me about the U.S. and the U.S. stock market is it's not as though the U.S. economy is in the doldrums. In actual fact, the U.S. economy has outperformed, let's say, every other developed market country. I think that's fair to say for sure. Some EMs have grown faster in the last 5 years. So the U.S. economy is actually running quite hot. There's low unemployment. There's relatively high inflation. The other thing that's, I think, an important point is for a country that's running very hot and growing fast, that would normally be the time you'd be running a budget surplus because your tax collections are strong, things are fantastic. So you should be running a budget surplus and paying off debt. In actual fact, it's quite the opposite. The U.S. budget deficit is concerningly high. Okay, so now you've got Donald Trump coming in, who's basically said, I'm going to stand on the gas even harder than Biden or anybody. So what does that mean? Well, it's hard to take an economy from running hot to running red hot. So things are already pretty good. The other thing that you have to consider is inflation. So it's quite interesting to me just how strong the dollar's been since Trump was elected. Because if you look at his policies, I think we're fair to say the vast majority are quite inflationary. Let's say tariffs. You're going to onshore manufacturing to America, but you already have full employment. So who's going to do this work? It's likely you'll push prices. So the reason the dollar's been strong is people saying, yes, there's going to be inflation, but therefore the Fed's not going to cut rates. So people are going to pay the carry trade. But actually, in the long term of currency value, inflation is more important than rates. So in actual fact, I think the dollar it's already strong. You look at a purchasing power parity. You look at what wages are in America, they're already high. So I find it surprising just how strong the dollar's been. And I think Trump will struggle to accelerate the growth in the U.S. economy. And maybe just an example of a stock that's done very well since Trump was elected is if you look at some of the banks. JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs have run very hard. But go and look at JP Morgan's ROE. JP Morgan is making the highest ROE now than it has since pre-global financial crisis. So what's that, 16 years ago. So the last 16 years, it's at its most profitable level. So Trump's changes are supposedly going to step up that profit another step. It's hard to go from very profitable to very, very profitable. And suddenly, people are paying the highest valuation they have for those high earnings since pre-GFC. So you kind of get that combination of already high earnings. And because people are excited about Trump, they're paying an ever higher price for those high earnings, which I think, you know, has to give you pause to concern.
Elon Musk and his role in the White House and the impact that might have for investors?
That's an interesting question. And for sure, Elon Musk is an astounding entrepreneur. It's just creating businesses left, right, and center, which are now extremely profitable and very, very valuable. How much impact will he have on the White House, or let's say the administration? I think it'll be tricky. The first thing, Mr. Musk must be extremely busy. So if I was a Tesla investor, my one concern will be, well, how much money, how much time is he going to spend on U.S. domestic affairs, and how much time is he going to spend leading the business that I'm paying quite a lot for because I want him involved? So that's my one question. The other thing is, for someone like that, and I actually know someone who was very high up in Tesla, and from my understanding from his, is Musk's management style is quite dictatorial. It's like, do this and it happens, and he makes very quick decisions. I don't think that'll work in a government, unless you just fire everybody, which you probably can't. So will he have a huge impact on regulation and getting the government to unwind? I'm not so sure. The other thing that's important to know about the U.S. government, so is he saying, you know, what's the big hope? You cut government spending, you cut government waste a huge amount. But actually, if you look where the U.S. government spends the vast majority of its money, I mean, vast majority, it's on things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then defense. And those are hard things to cut. So I don't know if Musk could have an outsized impact on the government, but I would be concerned about his attentions being diverted to that as opposed to focusing on his own businesses.
Si Jacobs says, he said at our Business News conference earlier this year, that his big short was Tesla. And he, when the latest results came out, I spoke to him briefly and he said, he's not confused. He's very confused because the share price, of course, has just gone up and up. But I guess he certainly isn't a buyer of Tesla, but he says it's very difficult to make any sense whatsoever on that share price. What you've explained now would, I believe, support Si's view that Tesla, at least if Elon Musk is spending less time on Tesla and he has a dictatorial management style, that can't be good news for shareholders.
No, I don't think so. Because when you're an investor in Tesla, and we're not, but I don't know, a short position in it, you betting or believing in the Musk exceptionalism continuing. He's going to develop very good self-driving cars, taxis, and they're going to become world dominant. Yeah, so having the person who's the key brain behind it not there is probably not a good thing when you're paying such a big valuation.
Okay, on to Bitcoin. This is an interesting one. In the past, I've asked Pietfer Lyon, who's one of the deepest of the deep value investors, what he thought of Bitcoin. He said he would put 2% of his portfolio into Bitcoin. He says he's actually buying it himself. He's buying a few every month because I guess it's on the basis that like gold or like the dollar, if enough people believe it has value, then it does get value. And that was his view. What's your thought on Bitcoin, especially now that it's getting to close to $100,000?
So Bitcoin's interesting for me because I used to know very little about it. And then a few years ago, I'm trying to get the dates right, it's probably 2022, thereabouts, I went surfing in Nicaragua and, El Salvador. I've also been to Nicaragua, but this was a surfing trip to El Salvador. And I was staying in a hotel, and El Salvador had adopted Bitcoin as legal tender. So you could pay in it, you could kind of, et cetera. But it also had quite a few Bitcoin people, there. The one that people I met at the hotel is actually a very interesting German guy. And his company He was the kind of head of tech of a company that was developing various Bitcoin wallets and methods to make transactional payments with Bitcoin easier, more seamless. And I have to say, he did convert me. I was like, this is actually, I can see this working. Before, I didn't understand how it worked. I didn't understand how you'd make transactions seamless. And after that, I thought, okay, well, if this does become, because you have companies like Western Union, et cetera, which who basically take poor migrant workers to the cleaners when they want to move money back to, let's just say, El Salvador. And you could see how Bitcoin could become an extremely useful transaction mechanism for this type of thing. And if you worked out, okay, how many, if you just worked out how many migrant workers are there in the world, if they each had a little bit in their wallet, because there's some Bitcoin tied up, you could quite easily get a kind of fair value for Bitcoin of quite a big number, like $40,000-$50,000 per unit. And at that time, I think it must have been around the FTX time, because I think it had sold off from 60,000 down to 20-ish thereabouts. And I was like, I was actually thinking about investing in it. So I thought, this is actually interesting. And I think if it does become the standard, so I can definitely see the story for Bitcoin. I think I see less of some of the kind of, let's call it periphery coins, the obviously kind of things of, there are lots of these smaller ones. I think it is like gold. It's the one people choose to invest in, and as happens to be Bitcoin. So would I buy Bitcoin now? I think there does seem to be quite a lot of hype in the market at this time. And usually it's better to invest in things when people dislike them. The kind of, you know, one of the mantras that Short and I use is capital flowing into the industry or out of the industry. Because often when capital is flowing out of an industry, you end up getting better returns. And when capital is flowing into an industry, your future returns could well be lower. So I think if you just look at ETF flows, for instance, in the last month, there'd be very strong flows into Bitcoin. And I think it is an investment. The one thing you got to think about in Bitcoin is, if you just think how strict banks are around the world with money laundering, etc., I think banks might try, or let's say call them central banks / government, clamp down on the transactional use of Bitcoin, given that it could be used for illegal purposes. Obviously, Trump has got a different view. Whether those views come to pass is, I suppose, a different story, because he says a lot, but maybe some of those things are tricky to implement. But for sure, I'm not a Bitcoin hater. Do I own Bitcoin? No. Do I wish I had bought Bitcoin at 20,000? Of course. That's kind of a bit of a roundabout corner. But as I said, I think it is something, once you have a better understanding of it, it's far easier to think, oh, this could be it's a limited supply. Actually, supply is far more limited than gold.
That's an interesting approach, because usually from professional money managers, the response is, I don't understand it, I'm not investing in it. But in your case, you've taken the effort to understand it, and presumably you've got a fair value, which, as you mentioned earlier, was if the migrant workers were to use Bitcoin, you could get to $40,000. But when you're sitting at $100,000, that's other people's opportunity and perhaps too high a risk for you.
Well, I suppose at the higher levels, what changes the fair value is how much of the Bitcoin is tied up in non-transactional hands. So if suddenly more is in the ETF, it leaves less Bitcoin in the transactional hands. So therefore, you need a higher price to have a certain amount of float in the transactional world. But I mean, that's just one way of looking at it. But I think the other way of looking at it is a scarce resource. And in this world, there are actually not many scarce resources. That, you know, money gets printed at will. As we said, the US government's running a large deficit. They don't seem to be very concerned about the dollar.
If I put it to you differently, had you bought at $20,000, would you be selling now?
Probably not. You know, because it's like one of those things that I know psychologically that's the wrong answer, because I'm saying, you know, you look at something like, if we didn't own it, would we buy it now? That's how we look at stocks. We look at a stock in the portfolio, which has run hard. We say, you know, if we didn't own stock X, would we buy it now? No, we wouldn't. So, but I think Bitcoin is somewhat different in that it's kind of, it's not your whole of your portfolio. It's a part of your portfolio that you've bought to hold for the long term because you are concerned about the devaluation of currencies. You're concerned about tail events, that type of thing. As an investor, I'm not talking about as a transactional wallet type person.
So just ride the bumps if they are to happen now, because you, the reason why you bought it was not to trade in it, but was because of your concerns or potential concerns about the risk in fiat currencies. I think that's, if I understand you correctly, if you're already
in
there,
that's right.
Well, just remember why you're in there.
And it's truth. You probably know, because I haven't kept. So Bitcoin was 21 million coins in the end. Is that right?
It gets to 22 eventually, but we're at 21.
Okay, so 22 million.
So a few to come, yeah.
At $100,000 per unit, that's how much is that? I'm trying to think the market cap of Bitcoin in, you know, as we've got companies now that are $3.5 trillion. Suddenly, it's actually not such a massive number compared to other financial asset classes. I mean, because if Bitcoin was, let's just say it was $1 million and there are 22 million units, that would be, if there are 22,000 units, that would be 22 billion. Actually, I won't do the numbers
2.2
now.
2.2 trillion.
It actually is quite
a
big number at $100,000. It's like, I think it's 2.2 trillion. I think it's 2.2 trillion at 100,000, which is, it's big. It's not crazy.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the context of some of those other stocks that we've got in the portfolio, like NVIDIA. And it was so interesting last night on our business briefing. We had a clip from our partners at Bloomberg on one of the money managers, and he started off by saying, oh, he loved the results from NVIDIA, and it's going to 4 trillion. By the end of the interview, which was only 2 minutes later, he said 4.5. So it really has caught the imagination there. But let's move back to our six issues that are bothering me. This one was the escalation of hostilities in the Ukraine war, where now we have both Britain and the US allowing Ukraine to send long-range missiles into Russia. The Russian response to send an intercontinental ballistic missile into Ukraine as part of an immediate kind of reaction from Putin, almost warning it could have a nuclear warhead next time. How are you reading that as an investor?
As I said, I read this totally wrong in the first time. I didn't think Putin would invade. Our thinking was he was just kind of jerking the chain of the West, like threatening to invade, but it wouldn't actually do it. There's a very good guy. He's a Danish defense strategist called Anders Puck Nielsen, I believe his name is. And I highly recommend people. I think he's got a YouTube channel and he writes some stuff, but he speaks with a lot of sense. And one of the things he said, which kind of struck me, is the problem is when people think about Putin, they think about what they would do. Like, what would a sane person do? Or what would someone with their view of the world do? And my former colleague, Sandy McGregor from Alan Gray, always used to say, people see the world from where they sit. So, yeah, I see the world from a Western outlook, or I see the world from this type of outlook. That's not where Putin sits. Putin has a worldview which is different from your view or my view. And he genuinely believes that he's under threat and people want to attack him and things like that. And he genuinely believes that it was a huge mistake for the USSR to break up, and these countries are actually Russian and should be part of Russia and want to be part of Russia. And he's just helping them. So I suppose the question is, well, there's a few questions here. Is letting Ukraine use Western weapons to strike further into Russia an escalation? I know there have been lots of these escalations. There have been, you know, this escalation is going to lead to World War III. This one's going to lead to World War III. Up to this date, none of them have led to World War III. And does Putin want World War III? I don't know. I don't think the Chinese want World War III, which is quite important. So I think that is one thing that keeps him in check to some extent. And again, you'd think, oh, a sane person after Putin's experience would be somewhat chastened. Like, he's tried to invade Ukraine. It hasn't been much of a success. Maybe we should step back. But that would be the logical, sane person's way to think. And it's possibly not the way Putin thinks. So has the odds of war gone up materially because they're letting long-range missiles hit, let's call them Russian defense stockpiles or weapon stockpiles? I don't know. I think probably not. I mean, they've been sending other missiles into Russian territory for a while now. So Putin has to do something to show he's doing something for the Russian people. He's going to say, oh, I've escalated. I've used an intercontinental ballistic missile to use a conventional warhead. And he's also obviously changed the nuclear doctrine to, I can't remember the exact wording it's changed. And therefore, the European stock market has been quite weak. So there are two ways to look at it. The one is, well, Europe's just going to be nuked. The stocks there are worth nothing. Or alternatively, it's potentially a buying opportunity. We at Ranmore are finding far more value in Europe than we are in the US. So we would say it's potentially a buying opportunity. But, you know, literally, if World War III starts, you could say we're all dead anyway, so it doesn't matter. In truth, I mean, if you've got fallout or nuclear war, like, you can own any stock. It's not going to make a difference. Then you best be in gold or physical or farmland.
Or Bitcoin.
Or Bitcoin. Something along those lines.
Okay, so that is a worrying factor, and it is something that one has to pay attention to. Even more worrying for people who've been watching the Oracle of Omaha over many years is the massive selling spree that he's been on and the cash pile that he's built of $325 billion. Do you take any messages from that?
For sure I take a message from it, and I think we find ourselves in the same spot, because I think, well, let's say Berkshire Hathaway has been a majority U.S. investor. They tend to buy U.S. stocks. And when you're that large, you can't be wasting your time with European stocks. It's not big enough. So you've got to be in the U.S. And when we at Ranmore look at the U.S., we struggle to find value. We about 20% of our portfolios invest in American companies, as opposed to, I think, the world markets, let's call it in the 70s. It's not because we hate America, we think America's a disaster. It's just that we look at the valuation and the metrics, whether that be return on capital, return on equity, the prices you're paying for those companies, of companies in Europe versus companies in America, or companies in Latin America versus companies in America, and we don't find the value in the U.S. So I think that's exactly why Warren Buffett. I mean, if you look at Apple, Apple's been a fantastic investment for him. But in truth, if you take a hard look at Apple, you say, well, growth has slowed down quite a lot. It's not growing. I mean, they're growing margins, but revenue growth is not incredible. It's hard for them to step up the revenue growth without a great new product, which doesn't seem to be on the horizon. And you're paying, I don't know the P multiple off the top of my head, but I think you're paying historic multiple of 35, something like in the 30s. which is high compared to its history. I mean, I think in the early, like 2011, 12, 13, you're paying 11, 12, 13 times for Apple. So you're paying three times that multiple for a company that is just mathematically has got less growth potential now than it did 10 or 15 years ago. So it seems sensible to me. It's his biggest position. He's taking some profits and he's struggling to deploy that. Why is he struggling to deploy it? Because it's hard to find value in the US stock market at the moment.
Another flag, if we were using Clem Sunter's approach to life, that is waving quite strongly. And then finally, I'm not sure how much attention you're paying to South Africa, being a South African living abroad. The government of national unity has given a lot of hope to people in this country, and it does appear to have lifted the mood, well, that and the Springboks. Is there the fragility of the government of national unity something that investors should be worried about?
To an extent, but not, I don't think overly. For me, and I do follow the SA market kind of from a distance. I'm on the board of City Lodge, so obviously that's in the hotel and entertainment industry. It's, you know, relatively economically sensitive. So I think the mood is definitely lifted. People are more positive, but are people putting their money where their mouth is? That doesn't quite seem to be the case yet. And there are some tricky hurdles, especially in the north of the country, that SA has to overcome, whether it be generally weaker commodity prices, the coal industry outlook not looking fantastic, the iron ore industry outlook not looking fantastic, PGMs not fantastic. So you've got to overcome that with other growth. And you look at, now that I spend a lot more time looking at Southeast Asia and things like that, you think, well, for SA really to grow, like let's say you want to have huge employment growth, that kind of thing, we need to be exporting more, producing more. And you look at our position versus, let's say, Vietnam or Thailand or Indonesia, and the cost of doing business, the growth potential of the market, the education level, and I think that's probably the most important thing, the education level of the average person coming out of high school in South Africa versus, let's just say, Vietnam. South Africa's got a lot of catching up to do, and that's going to be hard. So for South Africa's GDP to suddenly start growing 2-4% a year, it's going to take a massive effort. And I hope the new government can make some steps along that path, but it's going to be tricky to change the whole psyche of the country, the whole education system, to really get running along that path. And then just from a pure investment point of view, I know people often say things like, oh, South African banks are so cheap. Or maybe in the South African context, but if you're a global investor like we are, I can get a Colombian bank for far less than I can buy a South African bank, or I can buy an Eastern European bank or a Southeast Asian bank. So we look at it like that. It's just like, which country has got better economic prospects? Where am I paying less? Or I'd prefer to invest there than here. So it's not that we do have one stock in South Africa, and we've looked at other ones, but the value of the stock market doesn't jump out at us as screening particularly cheaply. And people are very positive in South Africa, and that positivity has been reflected in the stock markets. We more of, if things were really bad, then we'll go and look.
You've said you've got one stock in South Africa. I would be most remiss not to ask you which one.
It's AECI. So we own a small position at AECI. We've been reducing it in the last little while, but yeah.
So this has been a fascinating conversation. And if I extrapolate it all to the kind of portfolio that you would be putting together today, what would it look like? It doesn't seem to me as though it would have Palantirs and NVIDIAs in it.
No. So, and in truth, you asked right at the beginning, how do we manage such a small team? And one of the things we do is we don't spend much time at all looking at things where we don't think I've got a competitive advantage. So did I look at the NVIDIA results? No, I did not. Why? Because, like, do I have an edge in NVIDIA? I've got no edge whatsoever. I presume they're 60 sell-side analysts poring over those numbers, a million buy-side people poring over those numbers. Am I going to pick up something they're not? No, this is not going to happen. So I have no edge there. So I don't spend actually any time looking at those kind of things. So if you're saying, if you invest like us, which I'm not saying is the right way or the wrong way, it's just how we invest, we looking at the world saying, where are things great and people are overly positive, and where are things not great and people are overly pessimistic? So from what I said earlier, you probably established that we think things in America are going fantastically well. Things are going fantastically well. That people are extremely positive in US stocks. There was actually a chart in the, there was a chart, I think it was in the FT this last week, that showed European stock market versus US stock market annual returns the last 20 years. And the US stock market has outperformed the European market in 8 of the last 10 years, which is quite incredible, and 25% in the last year. So some would say, oh, that shows the US is just better and it will continue to do that forever. So we don't think that. We think an American brain is just the same as a European brain or a Chinese brain or an African brain. And that's probably not the case. So we look at places people don't like. So China, we were big in China earlier this year, but then it had its big blow off and we sold most of our Chinese stocks. It's coming all the way back again. We're looking there. We're looking at Japan. Why? Because the currency has been very weak in Japan and there's some companies which are showing value there. We're looking at Europe. Why? Because people hate Europe at the moment. Germany's for sure in quite a bad recession. People are worried about Putin throwing nuclear weapons at Europe. People are worried about the French government and the French government deficit, which I agree with. It is extremely concerning. But there are companies, good companies, which get thrown out of the bathwater, which we're looking at. Like, we don't own the stock, but even something like, just as we're speaking, something like Pernod Ricard. So Pernod Ricard, they make liquor, which is a branded good. And I think people are less likely to buy supermarket brand scotch. You know, they want to buy, if they're a whiskey drinker, they want to drink a nice whiskey that they know the brand. So I think the brands of those companies is worth a lot. Pernod Ricard the last 2 years has halved, actually halved. It's now suddenly in a 4.5% dividend yield, only like 15 times earnings. You know, so that's a company which is not that affected by the French government, except for tax, which is halved. So those are the kind of things we're starting to look at, like where value is starting to bubble to the surface. It's very hard to find that kind of business in America where you think, oh, actually, this is quite a good business at a reasonable price. So, yeah, that's where we're looking. We're looking where other people are looking less, basically.
So it's a time, perhaps, on our portfolios because we were originally looking where other people weren't looking less. Now we've had an incredible run, is to, well, say thank you very much for the run that we've had. Our advantage is now gone. And let's just take a step back and perhaps start looking at those opportunities that, once again, you can sleep easily at night. Because right now, I'll give you an example of MicroStrategy, which we bought at the equivalent of $40, and it's now $400. So it's been 10 bagger in 18 months. So,
fantastic.
But it can drop 20% in a day. So it's one of those crazy things because of its gearing to Bitcoin. So I guess that unless you have the ability to not sleep at night, if you want to be a happy investor and you want to sleep at night, you need to de-risk. Would you agree with that?
I think, I mean, judging that by how well your portfolio is done, I think you should be giving me advice, not me giving you advice. But I think you've always got to look at the range of outcomes. There's obviously everything's got a range of outcomes, and where that range of outcomes is weighted against you, possibly, it's always good to take some profits. If things come back again, you can always reinvest that money. But we are quite big fans of trimming our winners, because you bought a stock at, let's say, MicroStrategy, you bought it at 40 because you thought it was cheap. Maybe you thought it was 100. You thought it was worth 100, you bought it at 40. It's gone up, possibly, it sounds like, I don't know the valuation, to more than your fair value or more than you think Bitcoin's worth X. Well, then it's worth just taking into a lower risk position. Maybe they're lower risk ways to do the same strategy or play the same trend. And I think that is good, because losing money is not nice to everybody. And unfortunately, people's mind is marked at the high watermark, not the low watermark. So things have done exceptionally well. Usually it's a good idea to just trim those a little bit, take some profits, reinvest, and sow the seeds for the future harvest.
Andrew Lapping, Chief Investment Officer at Ranmore, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your insights with us today. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.